Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the GE Capital Investor Meeting. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. My name is Jeanette, and I will be your conference coordinator today. If at any time during the call you require assistance, please press star followed by zero, and a conference coordinator will be happy to assist you. If you experience issues with the slides refreshing or there appears to be delays in the slide advancement, please hit F5 on your keyboard to refresh. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the program over to your host for today's conference, Matt Cribbins, Vice President of Investor Communications. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome, everyone. We are pleased to host today's webcast on GE Capital. We issued the press release and presentation earlier this morning on our website at www.ge.com/investor. As always, elements of this presentation are forward-looking and are based on our best view of the world and our businesses as we see them today. Those elements can change as the world changes. Please interpret them in that light. For today's webcast, we have our Chairman and CEO, Jeff Immelt, Vice Chairman and CEO, GE Capital, Keith Sharon, CFO, Jeff Bornstein, General Counsel, Brackett Dennison, and Treasurer, Dan Janki. Now I'd like to turn it over to our Chairman and CEO, Jeff Immelt.
Thanks, Matt. Today, we're announcing a definitive step in our evolution to create a focused infrastructure and technology company. We plan to sell most GE Capital assets over the next 18 to 24 months and remain primarily in core verticals and markets GE knows best. Going forward, GE Capital ending net investment will be about $90 billion, with only $40 billion in the United States. Here are some of the key reasons for this action. Our industrial businesses are performing well. We continue to see opportunities for growth and margin expansion. We remain on track for industrial EPS in 2015 of $1.10 to $1.20, up strong double digits. More than 90% of GE's earnings will come from industrial businesses. This will create substantial shareholder value. These actions create $35 billion of capital that will be returned to the parent. There's potential to return $90 billion to shareholders over the next few years via the buyback, the Synchrony exchange, and the GE dividend. Our board has authorized a buyback of up to $50 billion, excluding Synchrony. This is an excellent time to sell financial assets. We think that Synchrony's performance and the Australia consumer finance value demonstrate that our platforms may be worth more outside the company. In addition, we announced the sale of our commercial real estate platform, roughly $26 billion of assets. With the announced commercial real estate transaction, we have about half of our 2015 goals for asset sales already achieved. To facilitate our asset sales, we plan to take a day-one charge that writes off goodwill, taxes, and shortens the hold period in certain assets. This is primarily non-cash. We see this as positive for bondholders and regulators. We've amended our IMA agreement to guarantee the GE Capital debt supporting bondholders. We do not expect to issue any GE Capital debt for at least 5 years. And our action eliminates a large wholesale-funded non-bank SIFI, and we're working with regulators on SIFI de-designation. This is exactly what was envisioned by the FSOC process. Lastly, our underlying business performance in the first quarter of 2015 and our expectations for the year are consistent with our guidance and framework, and we'll give you an update on that next Friday. You know, we've been improving our business mix while growing EPS since the financial crisis. A decade ago, GE Capital was more than 50% of GE's earnings as we experienced headwinds in our power and aviation businesses. Today, our industrial businesses are doing great, and our biggest decisions have been centered on the value of GE Capital. Since 2008, we said that we would take actions in financial services that were primarily in our control and benefit investors. And we have methodically reduced the business in ways that created asset value. Including Synchrony and commercial real estate, we've sold about $200 billion in net investment at a substantial net gain. Today's announcement is in that same vein. We can execute this plan while generating value for investors. The future for GE is as an industrial company, one in which our financing capabilities advantaged because of unique knowledge of assets and markets. With more than 90% of our earnings coming from industrial businesses, we believe that it should be easier for investors to value the company. Going forward, all of our businesses benefit from our enterprise strength, what we call the GE Store. Recently, you visited our Global Research Center to see the integrated strength of our broad and deep technical leadership. We also view our global scale, huge installed base delivering customer outcomes, and lean structure to be important advantages. And increasingly, financing is a key part of the GE store. These advantages should translate to improved growth and margins. GE going forward has the capability, the growth prospects, and the returns to earn a premium industrial valuation in the future. Now let me turn it over to Keith.
Thank you, Jeff. As you all know, we've done a lot over the last 6 years to shrink GE Capital while also making it much safer. As of year-end 2014, our ending net investment was down $175 billion to $363 billion. We reduced both our real estate and our global mortgage books by over 60%. We also completely changed our balance sheet as we reduced our commercial paper from over $70 billion to $25 billion, and we increased our liquidity from $37 billion to over $75 billion. We also significantly increased our capital levels and reduced our overall leverage. On the negative side, with our unsecured debt-funded model, we have a funding disadvantage versus the banks, who have much less expensive deposits, and our return on equity in 2014 was 8.6% below GE's cost of capital. As we look forward post-synchrony, our return on equity will be even lower. So while we became much safer, we also had a negative impact on our ability to generate acceptable returns on our capital. That leads me to the next page. Why now? Several factors have come together to make this the right time for this strategic change. First, as I covered on the previous page, our business model has become much less competitive. Second, the success of Synchrony and other dispositions like our Australia consumer finance business give us tangible proof points that other owners place more value on our platforms than our own investors do as part of GE. Third, we see a very attractive market for selling our assets. Just based on rumors over the last few weeks, we've had a significant amount of inbound inquiries to buy our businesses. I'll cover our track record in a few pages. Fourth, there's been more discussion around the SIFI de-designation process. De-designation guidance was published in February, and the recent congressional hearings gave us additional input on regulatory thinking around the subject. And fifth, we have a plan that we believe works for all of our major constituents. It's taken quite a bit of work to develop this plan. We've addressed bondholder, shareholder, and regulatory issues with plenty of internal and external expertise. I'll cover some of the details, and then Dan Janke and Jeff Bornstein will cover more on the structure and financial impact of this plan. Bottom line, we think the timing's right to execute this strategic shift. So next, I'll cover the portfolio strategy. The two bars on the left side of this page add up to the $360 billion of ending net investment as of year-end 2014. The far-left bar represents the investment that we plan to exit. The top section represents $75 billion of dispositions that are already underway, including Synchrony. The next section is the $35 billion of real estate that we announced today. So 40% of our total exits are underway or announced. And the balance is the rest of our global consumer assets and all of our commercial lending and leasing platforms. The bar on the right represents the investment that we plan to have going forward, mostly the verticals, and I'll cover more on the go-forward GE Capital in a few pages. On the right side, we list the key execution factors for this plan. The first and most important step for us was to make sure we executed this plan while keeping stability in the capital markets. As of today, we're modifying the existing income maintenance agreement between GE and GE Capital, and we're providing a full GE guarantee on the GE Capital debt. Dan Janke is going to cover more on this in a few pages. Later this year, we'll be executing an internal reorganization of GE Capital to ensure that we honor our bondholder covenants. With this plan, we'll take our commercial paper down to $5 billion by year-end 2015, and we don't plan to be issuing any incremental GE Capital debt for at least the next 5 years. The second key to execution will be to work responsibly with all of our regulators. As we sell assets, we'll be building liquidity and also capital levels. Dan and Jeff will cover our plans in both of those areas. We expect to sell our U.S. assets quickly, and our goal is to apply for de-designation as early as possible. Our objective is to be in a position to apply sometime in 2016. We also have a plan to form a U.K. holding company to hold our global assets, and that we will have a consolidated EU regulator for those operations. And third, we have a tremendous amount of work to do to execute the sales. While we're very interested in obtaining the right value for our shareholders, we're also going to be balancing speed with certainty. So let me look at the track record. I mentioned we have a good track record here on dispositions. On the left side of the page, you can see that over the past 6 years, we've sold over $100 billion of businesses and assets while realizing $4 billion of gains. We've sold banks and bank stakes in Thailand, Turkey, Russia, and Central America. We've sold our consumer fincos in the Nordics, Switzerland, and Singapore. We've done straight asset sales, platform sales, structured sales over time, IPOs. We've sold to banks, other fincos, and private equity players. and we've exited dozens of smaller hard-to-sell platforms. We have an excellent business development team that's very connected to the buyer universe, and now with this plan, we're going to be selling many very successful market-leading franchises. In the middle of the page is a brief synchrony update. Margaret Keane and her team continue to do an excellent job preparing for separation. We plan to file our application for separation in the April-May timeframe. We believe that we're on track for a late 2015 split, and you should continue to use 1/1/16 for planning purposes. At current prices, we'd realize about a $2.5 billion after-tax gain and effect a 700 to 800 million share buyback in the exchange. On the right side is a summary of the real estate exit that we announced today. We've reached a definitive agreement to sell $22.5 billion of our real estate assets to Blackstone and Wells Fargo. This deal includes $3.5 billion of seller financing, which we will syndicate to the market by mid-2016. In addition, we have several deals with letters of intent representing $4 billion worth of real estate exits that we expect to finalize in Q2. Together, these deals cover 100% of our equity book and most of our debt book and represent $26 billion of real estate assets sold at book value. We'll be retaining $3 billion of debt, including $700 million of volume that we funded in March and just didn't have time to sell yet. We expect all the remaining $3 billion of debt to be sold by year-end 2015, and we'll be taking a $2.4 billion after-tax charge related to the exits to cover goodwill write-off, taxes, and transaction costs. Again, Jeff will be covering the entire day one charge in a few minutes. So if you look at the deals we've completed, plus Synchrony, plus real estate, we'll have sold $200 billion of assets and platforms for a net gain, and this gives us a lot of confidence as we embark on this new plan. So next page, next a little more color on the platforms and assets that we plan to sell. I covered the real estate transaction. For commercial lending and leasing, we have the leading businesses in middle market lending, distribution, and equipment finance. In our global fleet business, we're the market leader in the U.S. We have strong positions in developed markets in Europe and Asia. Our mid-market sponsor business is also the market leader in the U.S. with a tremendous team in the GE Ontario's platform. The balance of our U.S. CLL business defines the middle market lending. We have leading positions in healthcare lending, inventory finance, transportation finance, franchise finance, and equipment finance. We have over 1,450 direct originators and more than 260,000 customer and dealer relationships. Our international CLL business has similar strengths in mid-market leveraged lending and leading positions in factoring. And we'll continue to exit our remaining global consumer platforms, including our global mortgages and remaining global banks. To help us execute, we've hired J.P. Morgan to work with us as a global coordinator for this disposition plan. And when you look at the total left to go, overall we have about $165 billion to go, and we're already in discussions on several of those platforms. So next I want to just give you a snapshot of G Capital going forward. The left side shows the ending net investment forecast for the next several years. You can see that we plan to shrink rapidly. Our goal is to get down to $90 billion globally by the end of 2017. Our estimates are that we'll have about $50 billion of ANI outside the U.S. and about $40 billion in the U.S. On the right side, you can see that the future GE Capital segment will have about $1.5 billion in net income and a 13% return on tangible equity, ex insurance. We plan on giving you the pro forma financial information for this future GE Capital every quarter as we go forward. And next is just a brief look at the core verticals. You're all familiar with them. We have a market-leading position as the largest aircraft lessor in the world with GECAS. 85% of our fleet's powered by GE or CFMI engines, and we have a great global team with deep customer relationships. Our energy financial service business has $14 billion of investment. We have a strong relationship with GE Power and Water, and we're growing our relationship with GE Oil and Gas. And our healthcare equipment finance business has a strong synergy with the GE healthcare team. So overall, three strong platforms that really help GE industrial businesses compete and win in the marketplace. Now let me turn it over to our treasurer, Dan Janke.
Thank you, Keith. I'll take you through the expected funding and liquidity profile as we execute this plan. First, I'd like to reinforce an important element of executing this plan that Keith mentioned earlier. We amended the income maintenance agreement to provide a guarantee on all GE Capital's tradable senior and subordinated debt securities and commercial paper issued or guaranteed by GE Capital. We believe this provides clear GE support of GE Capital's debt securities and the flexibility to execute this new plan. Now let's go to the funding profile. We ended 2014 with $350 billion of total funding. We expect to reduce this by $260 billion over the 5 years, with $230 billion of that occurring in the first 3 years. The drivers of that reduction are the following. No new GE Capital long-term debt issuances for at least 5 years. We will reduce our commercial paper program by $20 billion, down to $5 billion before year end. Additionally, $121 billion of long-term debt matures or is callable over this period. And then lastly, $58 billion reduction is associated with exiting securitization and deposit platforms as we sell the businesses they directly fund. So our plan is to execute this in a very safe and secure manner. We'll maintain elevated liquidity positions as we generate cash from asset sales. As you can see, we will maintain a 24-month liquidity coverage ratio of 145 to 210% before returning to more normalized levels in 2019. With this strong liquidity position, we will opportunistically evaluate buying back debt and other liability management actions based on interest rates and the economics of those transactions. We reviewed this plan with both Moody's and S&P. As you saw in their morning notes, the plan has limited impact on ratings. First, no change to GE Capital issuer rating. S&P affirmed GE's rating. Moody's reduced GE by one notch. Based on Moody's rating, GE still remains one of the highest rated U.S. industrial companies and one of the top six globally. Both firms maintain stable outlooks for both GE and GE Capital. So in summary, these actions result in a smaller, simpler funding footprint that substantially reduces the wholesale funding risk as we go forward. So now let me turn it over to Jeff. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. On the next few pages, I'll take you through the financial expression of this plan. I'll start with the expected charges associated with remaking of GE Capital. We expect the charges in the first quarter to total approximately $16 billion, driven by the following four components. First, we expect to book a loss of $3 billion associated with the businesses being moved to held for sale in the first quarter, with an expectation that they will be sold in the next 12 months. These businesses include our sponsor finance business, our healthcare assets that are unrelated to our GE industrial healthcare business, our commercial business in Australia, the fleet leasing business, and our UK inventory finance business. In total, those businesses represent $45 billion of assets. Second, we will record a $5 billion of impairments associated with businesses and assets that we expect to sell over the course of this plan, for which the change in expected hold periods necessitated reevaluating the carrying value of those assets. These impairments are largely driven by our European mortgage portfolios, our investment in Asian JVs, and our commercial assets. Third, we will repatriate about $36 billion of cash at a cost of approximately $6 billion as we resize our international operations. And finally, as Keith discussed, we'll take a charge in discontinued operations of $2 billion for the agreement to sell our commercial real estate business. We will exit real estate at roughly book value for the assets. The charge is attributable to the write-off of goodwill, currency translation, transaction costs, and tax assets associated with real estate. In totality, we estimate the charges for exiting all but the vertical businesses to be about $23 billion. The incremental $7 billion will be driven principally by additional business dispositions, including goodwill write-offs, restructuring, and retention costs. Of the $23 billion of total estimated exit costs, roughly $6 billion will be cash-related. All of these estimates exclude the anticipated gain in discontinued operations of $2 to $3 billion associated with the final split-off of our Synchrony shares. Next, I'll cover a simplified look at the expected pro forma earnings for GE Capital over the next 4 years. I want to emphasize that this plan may change as the timing of asset sales evolve. At the top of the page, I'll start with the verticals operating segment. The segment includes aviation leasing, healthcare equipment finance, energy financial services, working capital solutions, and the remainder of our insurance business. We expect the segment to earn about $1.6 billion in 2015, and about $1.4 billion in 2016. Earnings will be down in 2016, driven by lower tax benefits as a result of this plan. We expect the run rate earnings of the segment to be about $1.5 billion a year, including their own headquarter costs, while earning an attractive return on tangible equity. This is what we will look to as continuing operating earnings for GE Capital. On the next two lines of the profile are the charges associated with executing the plan and the interest carry costs associated with debt in excess of the amount required to finance the vertical segment. These excess debt costs will reduce over time as we pay down debt maturities. These two lines get you to what we expect to be continuing earnings for GE Capital. Discontinued operations reflect the charges associated with the real estate business, as well as future charges for CLL and consumer. We expect that towards the end of this year, as we action additional CLL businesses, any platforms at that time or subsequently that are held for sale will move to discontinued operations. Additionally, when we effect the split off of Synchrony, any further consumer business sales will also move to discontinued operations. The gain in 2016 disc ops reflects the estimated gain on Synchrony, partially offset by other dispositions. To put this all within the context of our original framework for GE Capital in 2015, we expected the business to earn about $6 billion for the year, or 60 cents a share. Subtracting the day one charge of $16 billion I just walked through, the earnings that we will forego by selling businesses of $2 billion, and additional expected held for sale and restructuring charges of $2 billion is how you walk to our estimate today of a loss of $14 billion for the year 2015. Next, I'll cover how we're thinking about value. On the top left is our estimate for the E&I dispositions over the next 3 years. We have already actioned 50% of the plan for 2015, and over the next couple of years, these dispositions will unlock substantial amounts of capital. On the bottom left of the page are three scenarios that articulate the amount of capital we would expect to return to GE based on the asset reduction I just covered, and the amount of Tier 1 common capital we will operate with over this transition period. Taking the middle case, if we maintain 14% Tier 1 common for 2015 through 2018, GE Capital would dividend $1 billion in 2015, $18 billion in 2016, and $7 to $8 billion respectively in each of 2017 and 18, for a total of approximately $35 billion. In each of the three scenarios, the total dividend amount is $35 billion. Not returning capital above these levels would result in our Tier 1 common capital levels growing to an excess of 30%. We ended 2014 with 13% of Tier 1 common capital on a Basel III transitional basis. We will operate throughout the execution of this plan in a safe and sound manner, and will work with our regulators on determining the appropriate capital levels over the next few years. On the right side of the page, we've laid out how we think about the value of GE Capital. Today, our retained interest in Synchrony is valued at about $20 billion. As I walk through, we think the execution of this plan returns $35 billion of capital to GE. And we believe that the verticals, longer term, will represent at least $20 billion of value for shareholders. In total, we believe there is an excess of $75 billion of value in GE Capital, in addition to the value creation that these businesses create synergistically with our industrial platforms. Next, I'll cover what we think this means from a capital allocation perspective for shareholders. In this construct, we believe that we'll be in a position to return up to $90 billion or more of cash between 2015 and 18 through dividends, buybacks, and the Synchrony exchange. The dividend remains a priority for the company. We plan to maintain the current dividend through 2016 and expect it to grow thereafter. The current dividend yield on the stock is an attractive 3.7%. In the short term, our payout ratios will increase as a result of the charges associated with reducing GE Capital to just the verticals, but we expect the ratio to be in line with historic levels by 2018. Synchrony remains on track, and we anticipate the exchange for shares of GE to retire approximately $20 billion of our stock at today's valuation. Executing this plan gives us an opportunity to use up to $35 billion of the dividends to repurchase shares. As a result, the board has approved a new buyback authorization of up to $50 billion. The combination of GE Capital dividends and the Synchrony exchange affords us the opportunity to reduce our outstanding shares to 8 to 8.5 billion shares. Over time, we plan to be opportunistic on M&A, particularly bolt-on acquisitions where we see value and good returns and the chance to enhance the long-term value of our industrial franchises. Turning to the next page, there's no change to our industrial EPS outlook. At year-end, we guided to an expectation of $1.10 to $1.20 of industrial earnings in 2015, and we expect to deliver within that range. Longer term, we expect to continue to grow industrial earnings at a double-digit rate, driven by organic growth, our focus on gross margins and SG&A efficiency, the benefit of reducing shares outstanding, and the addition of Alstom to our portfolio. And finally, before I turn it back to Jeff, I wanted to give you a view on how we are thinking about the impact on EPS over time as we execute this plan. Starting with 2015 guidance of $1.70 to $1.80, on the left and moving to the right, the Synchrony split off will reduce EPS 7 cents a share as we lose 17 cents a share of earnings. That will be partially offset by 10 cents a share of accretion on the reduction of GE shares through the exchange. Executing this plan will reduce GE capital earnings per share by 25 cents, but we expect that to be offset with 25 cents a share of accretion in primarily industrial EPS as a result of buying back stock with GE capital dividend. And then consistent with our long-term view, we expect attractive industrial growth over the next 4 years. We anticipate that in 2018, we will generate about the same amount of EPS as we had planned, but with a mix of earnings that is not 75% industrial and 25% financial, but with greater than 90% of our earnings being generated by a set of world-class industrial infrastructure franchises. In addition, we think we will have significantly reduced the amount of enterprise risk associated with a large financial service business and improve the earnings quality of the company. So with that, I'll turn it back to Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. As I said at the outset, this is a pivotal day for GE. GE Capital has been an important part of the company and an important part of our valuation, both on the upside and the downside. Over the past few years, we have strengthened the balance sheet and focused the business while understanding the potential for GE to compete and generate long-term returns in financial services. We have decided that the best capital allocation decision is to invest in our leading high-tech industrial businesses. These businesses have the capability to generate exciting EPS growth and all benefit from every element of our competitive advantage. At the same time, we have an excellent track record of financial asset sales, and the demand for assets from the outside is robust. The actions announced today should generate substantial benefits for investors. We plan to return $90 billion to shareholders through buyback, the Synchrony split, and dividends. And we expect to deliver for you the same earnings profile by 2018 with more than 90% of our earnings from industrial. We think these actions lower risk for the financial system. From a regulatory standpoint, this eliminates a large wholesale-funded, non-bank SIFI, consistent with the goals for FSOC. We want you to see GE as a premier industrial. We think today's actions allow for more growth, more focus, improved consistency, and less risk. And we're running the company differently, and we believe there is substantial value for investors in the years ahead. Lastly, let me compliment Keith and the GE Capital team. They've led the business through a period of great change. They're very skilled and professional. Matt, now let's take some questions.
Thanks, Jeff. I'll turn it back over to the operator to open the lines up for some questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to withdraw your question, please press the pound sign or the hash key.
Questions?
Our first question comes from Scott Davis with Barclays. Please go ahead.
Hi. Good morning, guys.
Hey,
happy
Scott.
Friday.
Hey.
Congrats. This is
thanks.
This is big stuff, and I know we've all given you a lot of crap over the years, but this is a pretty good step for redemption. So thanks for that. That's my best apology I can make, by the way. That's as good as I can get. And
okay. Well, thanks, Scott.
You can keep your job a little longer, I guess.
Yeah. Good. Good.
Anyways, I'm looking at slide 12 at the exit costs and, you know, the $23 billion impact. I assume that if you had gains on any of the sales, that would be a natural offset to that. Is that a correct way to think about it?
Yeah, any gains beyond what we've already modeled in here would be an offset in here. We have some gains in here versus our carrying value at the asset level. They're masked by, as you can see on the top there, the goodwill that will take off. So if we outperform our assumptions here on what will move these assets and businesses for, then it would be an offset to the $23 billion.
Okay. Would you characterize your exit assumptions as mark-to-market today or conservative, or just give us a sense around that.
I think the values that we have here are our view of where we see values today. I think there's an opportunity dependent. We expect a lot of demand for these assets, Scott. So at some level, we're hopeful that we can outperform here, but I think that we've used the values here that we think these assets prudently would be valued at today.
We've outperformed expectations so far, Scott, on this process, but I think we've done this in a pretty conservative fashion.
Okay. And just a couple logistical things. I mean, the move to support the debt, is that to make sure you don't get any pushback from the debt holders on this move? I mean, it seems like a bit of a nuance to me, but trying to understand why you would need to do that.
No, I think it just, as I mentioned as I went through the slide, it just ensures that we provide clear GE support through this transition, and it allows the flexibility to execute the plan. So it's the right mechanism for this plan.
Okay. I'll get into that afterwards. And then just last, the tax implications. Is there some sort of a future tax rate that you're thinking about in terms of the remaining financial sub-assets and then GE Industrial as you think about even a couple years out?
Yeah, Scott, I would say that we expect the GE capital rate to be kind of low double digits on a prospective basis, a little higher than where we've been, obviously, recently, significantly higher than where we'd be post-synchrony without making this change. I don't think there's much of an impact on the GE Industrial rate. Now, the consolidated rate, because GE Financial Services is going to be a lower percentage of the total, the consolidated rate will be higher. It'll probably be something like 20% or thereabouts.
Okay. Congrats, guys, and I'll move on. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Scott.
The next question comes from Stephen Weniger with Bernstein.
Thanks. Good morning.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, so I guess I'll echo the congrats on an aggressive move here. I also want to just ask Jeff, we've talked a lot over the years about the challenge in making a big move like this from a tax leakage perspective and other execution factors. You know, what finally put you over the edge to believe that the cost of doing this, which is still significant, is outweighed by the benefits here? Was it more strategic than anything, or maybe just a little insight on that would be helpful?
Yeah, I think at its essence, Steve, this is a capital allocation decision. I mean, I just think with the clarity we have now around the business, around the funding model, around the regulatory regime, et cetera, that when you look forward, we just did not see an attractive proposition for getting return on capital that made sense for the company or made sense for shareholders. And so we have a window of opportunity here. We think that there's some appetite for fulfilling the vision of the FSOC and reducing systemic risk for financial institutions. We'd certainly do that. And the market for these assets is just extraordinarily attractive today. Low interest rates, tons of demand, lots of liquidity. And we just think as a capital allocation point, it just makes more sense to put these assets in a better place where they'll be valued more highly than them being valued in the stock today and return that capital back to the company.
I would just echo what Jeff said. You know, the cash element of the charge is, you know, manageable and I think not that bad. And then I just think we're at a moment in time that's quite strategic. I mean, you guys are on financial service companies. You've got slow growth, low interest rates, ton of liquidity, and search for yield. So we've seen that in all the sale processes we've been through, and I would echo what Jeff said. I just think the timing is really right to do this.
Okay, and what does this mean for M&A, the trade-off for buybacks versus M&A? Clearly you're offsetting all the dilution here, but is that really the primary issue, and does this now limit your M&A capacity even further?
You know, Steve, I would start with the fact that, you know, we're going to, you know, we plan to complete our biggest acquisition this summer. So we've got a ton of work ahead on creating value from Alstom. This allows for a couple, you know, $3 to $5 billion a year in bolt-on acquisitions as we work through this. And so we think we've got plenty of firepower to do what we need to do. And we've made good investments in our platforms. We've got you know, decent organic growth profile as we go forward as well. So I think the primary, you know, just again what Jeff said on capital allocation is we feel like the underlying plan to buy back stock is the right way to think about capital allocation.
Okay, and just a couple clarifying questions. I mean, how mature are those negotiations already besides the real estate stuff that you've already done? When should we count on real estate, some of these real estate transactions closing? Is CLL, you're thinking about pieces or the whole thing? Just a little more perspective so we can kind of think about how to model this.
Sure. Steve, this is Keith. I'd say that obviously the announcement today, the Blackstone is a finalized sales and purchase agreement. So that's real on the 22.5. We have active LOIs on the four that we just couldn't get all the way to a final purchase agreement. We believe we will execute those in the second quarter. And all these real estate deals, including the remaining debt that we have, we expect to close before the end of 2015. So Jeff Bornstein showed you that we have a $90 billion reduction of assets in 2015. With the real estate and the announced deals like Australia and Hungary, we'll give you 45 of that. And then we're going to go to work on the others. You know, we're going to work on our healthcare financial sponsor business. We're going to work on our sponsor business, GE Antares. We're going to work on our fleet business in the U.S. And so we haven't started that yet. I think we've had a lot of inbound inquiries, but the fact that we now have this out in the public will enable us to move really quickly on that. And we're really, you know, I think we have a plan of 90. We're going to try and do better than that. We think the market is right, and we're going to go as fast as we can.
Okay, congrats and good luck.
Thanks, Steve.
The next question comes from Julian Mitchell with Credit Suisse.
Hi, thank you.
Hey, Julian.
Hey, just wanted to follow up on the question around the guaranteeing of the debt and the extent to which that might limit the flexibility, let's say, on different exit mechanisms. For example, does it mean that other spin-offs are very unlikely and it's really all about going down the path of a direct asset divestment?
This is Keith again, Julian. I don't think that's going to limit us. I think, you know, with our exit plans, we don't have anything that's contemplated to be like Synchrony, I would say. You know, we're going to be selling platforms and assets, but I don't see anything in the guarantee that limits our ability to sell those assets. Dan showed you the liquidity plan. We'll build liquidity in excess of our current maturities, and we'll pay those down over time. So this one actually doesn't limit us that we can see in any way in the plan that we have today.
Yeah, Julian, I just put a little, both on Steve's question and Keith's. You know, since 2008 around GE Capital, we've said to investors that we're only going to move when we could take actions that were primarily in our control and felt like we could maximize shareholder value. And so I think you've seen us be suitably cautious since the financial crisis. And I think this action today is along the same line. You know, we think we can see a pathway to sell all of these assets, and we think we can do it at good valuation for our investors. So this is really consistent with past practices in some ways.
Thanks. And then just on that point, maybe just give some perspective on, you know, since the crisis, what the average kind of divestment multiple has been relative to the book value for the divestments out of GE Capital, and the extent to which, you know, as you said, it's a robust environment for transactions, you know, for your assets, how you see that multiple differing as you wind down these businesses in the next 3 years.
Well, we have a pretty good track record. On the $100 billion, there were over 40 transactions in there over the last 5 years, and we had a $4 billion net gain after the transactions in total. So, and we sold some pretty tough assets in there. We were not selling the best assets, as you know. So I feel pretty good about the track record. Going forward, we believe that we're going to realize proceeds in excess of tangible book value on the total $200 billion that we're going to embark on a disposition plan here. So we feel pretty good about it. We've done our own internal valuations. We've had third parties help us with evaluations to develop this plan. And if you just look at the evidence, take a look at Australia, the Australia-New Zealand consumer finance business. We put that into an auction, and we sold that at 2x book. That would be better than what we're estimating for the total proceeds that we're going to get out of these platforms that we plan to sell going forward. So I think we've got a reasonable plan. We've got a thoughtful plan, and we're going to execute it as quickly as we can. Speed is going to matter, and we're going to get good value at the same time.
Great. Thank you, and congratulations.
Thanks, Julian.
And our next question comes from Shannon O'Callaghan with UBS.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, Shannon.
Hey, can you just flesh out a little bit more the increased clarity that you got on becoming a SIFI D designation, let's say? I mean, was it really the less than $40 billion of E&I that you saw getting to in the U.S., or was there sort of more? You mentioned the hearings giving you some clarity, just maybe a little more color on what happened there.
Yeah, I can take a shot at it. We've obviously been just watching what is the FSAC saying. In February, there were some brief guidelines issued about the off-ramp, and that's a start. Obviously, no one's ever done it. And then, obviously, the hearings, the congressional hearings, I think you look at some of the commentary around the hearings. One, that SIFIs received higher capital charges to encourage them to shrink. Two, that if a SIFI actually changed its business model, they should come in and talk to the FSOC about the change and what it meant for the designation. And those things, those three things all line up with our strategy here around capital allocation. So, we're trying to achieve an objective that's good for the financial system, that's also really good for our shareholders. And I think we found that sweet spot here.
Okay, thanks. And then, mostly attention, obviously, on the big strategic move, but it was interesting that the industrial framework was reiterated for the year, which is kind of a statement given some recent pre-announcements this week and things. I mean, any puts and takes in terms of the 15 picture?
Yeah, we'll talk to you next week on the quarter, Shannon, and update you then.
All right, thanks.
We'll let the statement stand on its own.
All right, I'd take a shot.
Thanks.
And the next question comes from Deane Dray of RBC Capital Markets.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Hey, Deane.
And also add my congratulations. A couple questions. The first is just make sure I'm clear on some of the nomenclature, because at one time you talked about the non-core holdings at GE Capital. They were called non-core or red assets. And I know in Jeff Bornstein's prepared remarks, it looked like those were also being divested because you mentioned the UK mortgages. But maybe just size for us what those red assets were at the end of the year and the path of divestitures on those.
Sure. I think the easiest way is if you go back to page 6, our asset disposition plan, the red assets would be comprised in two buckets. There'd be the real estate equity. That was about $10 billion at the end of the year, and obviously we've sold that now. And then down at the bottom in international consumer, a lot of those are non-strategic, what's left, the 37. We also included Synchrony in non-strategic, obviously a great asset, but that's on its way out as well. So all of it will be on the way out here. We're selling it all.
And just to clarify, on the UK mortgages, what's the regulatory capital that gets released on those assets versus a business like Synchrony?
Well, it would be significantly less. I mean, there's less than $500 million of regulatory capital will released associated with UK home lending. So it's very small. It's a couple hundred million dollars. I mean, Synchrony obviously will be close to $20 billion of total equity that will be exchanging for GE shares in the exchange. So significantly less. The $35 billion that we're returning back to the parent does not include the Synchrony number, Dean. The Synchrony number is on top of that.
I'll just clarify. So Keith's exactly right. When you think about the plan that we just walked you through, even though we are going to try to outperform it in terms of speed, about a third of the capital generation that allows $35 billion of dividend to flow will get actioned and executed in 2015. So this is not way, way out there in 2017-18. We will start executing very, very quickly here.
Ray, just last question. Could you flesh out the thought process about the repatriating the cash? It really looks like this year across U.S. Public companies is going to be a record year of repatriating cash. So what's the thought process? How much tax incrementally? Are you just being, because of the structure of the sales, you had to do this, or was there any way opportunistic?
No, this is a function of executing this plan. So as part of this plan, we've got to resize our international operations, both the debt and the equity, get it capitalized properly. And as a part of that, we chose to repatriate $36 billion of cash at a $6 billion charge. That's roughly a 35% tax rate on the earnings we're bringing home. We're bringing home more than just earnings. We're also bringing home the initial investment that in the businesses that supported those earnings. So it just made sense as part of this plan. I just want to go back again and say it's a $23 billion headline charge, but it's about $6 billion of cash associated with it, with a total $23 billion charge. So I would say in the context of remaking GE Capital, you know, this is a pretty reasonable friction cost in the form of cash to get this accomplished that we feel pretty good about.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
The next question comes from Andrew Obin with Bank of America.
Yes, good morning.
Hey, Andrew.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to congratulate you, apparently, as per my compliance. But just a question on industrial balance sheet flexibility post the transaction. Am I correct to understand that we're not using of the industrial balance sheet to do this capital return?
The cash is coming from the capital balance sheet.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, the cash is coming from it within the capital balance sheet from offshore to onshore.
Yeah.
So all of your capital assumptions imply no use of the industrial balance sheet right now.
Yes. Right. Yes.
So the second question, talking about sort of down the line industrial balance sheet flexibility and exit from CLL and CFID designation. When do you guys think you can fully utilize the industrial balance sheets? What are the regulatory steps on GE Capital side to enable you to do that?
Well, Andrew, I don't think it's a function of the GE Capital balance sheet per se, other than executing this plan and getting GE Capital de-designated and resized and reshaped. At that point, at some point in the future, you know, we'll have decisions we'll have to make about, you know, how we want to most efficiently use the GE balance sheet. And
I guess what I was asking is that there is a linkage, there is a regulatory linkage between GE industrial balance sheet and GE Capital. And from that perspective, you know, the fact that you still continue to support GE Capital debt, what does that imply for ability to lever up GE Industrial? That's what I'm asking.
I understand your question. As Dan went through, we are going to maintain enormous amounts of liquidity. We'll have 24-month of maturity coverage in excess of 140% as we work through this plan. So that's effectively defeasing the maturities associated with that GE Capital debt. There is not going to be anything implied on the GE balance sheet for that debt as part of the guarantee. As long as GE Capital and the rating agencies are comfortable that the cash flows from GE Capital can be a source to repay those maturities, that debt will not be implied on the GE company metrics.
I think, Andrew, there's a time for this in a future discussion. I think we feel like we're safe and secure today. We're extremely highly rated industrial company, but there's more optionality down the road on the industrial balance sheet, and we'll discuss that at some time point in the future.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Jeff Sprague with Vertical Research.
Thank you. Good morning. Congrats on a very bold move here. Just a couple of housekeeping things. A lot of things have been kind of covered here. The decision not to go ahead and just disc op all this stuff, could you maybe speak to that? And does it go to the fact that you really only have like 25% of this, you know, with kind of a purchase agreement in hand?
No, it's just how the accounting rules work, Jeff. So, you know, real estate was its own segment within GE Capital. It was large, and so the decision to sell it took it straight through to disc ops. The deeper we get into CLL and then in consumer with Synchrony, subsequent to those big moves, enough of those segments will be held for sale or sold that anything from that point forward will go straight to disc ops as well. So it's just an accounting threshold.
Okay. And so on that point, you're obviously taking the big charge up front as you do kind of sign deals and move this stuff out. you should not expect any gains then coming back and into your earnings construct. Any gains now relative to these negative marks will just go through disc ops.
We'll be very transparent about how we perform against the baseline that we've given you here on implied gains in the total chart. And you'll see those either in continue or disc op depending on the timing, but we'll be very clear about what those are.
And then you characterized 2018 as being in line with your plan, but I don't think we know exactly what your plan is. I mean, it looks like, you know, if you do the top of your industrial range here of $1.20 and you grow that at 10, you're at like $1.60 in 2018, you know, 15, 20 cents of capital. It looks like you're guiding us to about $1.80 in 2018.
Well, Jeff, correct? I think you miss the buyback and you miss Alstom. You miss a lot of stuff that's in there. It's substantially higher than that.
Okay. It's not apparent.
Substantially. No, I think it is, actually.
Okay.
So I think it actually is.
All right.
So I think it's substantially higher than that.
All right. And then finally, what would you consider a normal payout ratio then as you think about the dividend going forward?
Around 50%.
Okay.
I think in the context, Jeff, of the dividend flat or growing. You know, in other words, I think the dividend is, you know, key for the stock, and I think that's the way investors ought to be thinking about it. And again, with all this buyback, the cash outlay on dividends is reduces dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks.
The next question comes from John Inch of Deutsche Bank.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. The press release says that the actions still allow room for opportunistic bolt-ons. Is there a way to frame what you guys mean by that? Because, you know, obviously we've got Baker Hughes, Halliburton assets that could be very substantial coming off. I think you historically, prior to Alstom, sized kind of deals above $4 billion is not likely to happen because they were too large. Is there any sort of an update to the thinking of how we would sort of describe the trajectory of bolt-ons, how big, sort of what you're thinking, big picture?
You know, John, so I think we've kind of built in the plan kind of a $3 to $5 billion annual type outlay on M&A. But, you know, we also have portfolio choices that we make all the time to sell industrial assets and buy other industrial assets. And so I think we've been pretty sure-footed around the portfolio to do the things we needed to do to improve the business. So I think we've attempted to make this a balanced plan, but one where the underlying buyback is quite positive.
And then has CCAR stopped? In other words, you had been going through this process, you know, probably creating distraction and so forth. Is this just now stopped and you can kind of focus on this plan, or is that still kind of concurrent? Is there some other event that we have to wait for approval of this, or like I'm just trying to understand how that works?
Yeah, John, this is Keith. I would say that you saw recently that there was a proposed 165 order on enhanced prudential standards for GE Capital. There was a comment period. That comment period closed, and there have not been final 165 rules published about GE Capital. So that's still open. You know, if it were published in the way it was disclosed, we'd be in private CCAR in 16 and public CCAR in 17, and so we're gonna have to see what that eventual rule says. We're gonna work constructively with the Fed on that, but we're still regulated by the Federal Reserve, and we will be until we ultimately receive SIFI-D designation.
Our goal in this plan is to get down to $40 billion of U.S. investment by somewhere right around the end of 2017.
That's right.
Okay, no, that makes sense. And then just lastly, going back to the point about raising industrial debt at the parent, pro forma, clearly you could raise a lot of money at the industrial parent that could be used for lots of different things, right? It would probably optimize shareholder value even further. What are your thoughts toward, does all this really have to sort of fall into place to be able to raise that debt? And then subsequent to that, you know, are you assuming any sort of GE industrial debt as part of the framework of share repurchase, or is this all pure standalone based on capital?
So I would say the answer to your second question is we don't assume any additional industrial leverage. This is just taking the capital and redeploying it to investors. And then I think on your first question, John, look, that's a different discussion for a different day. You know, I think this is where we are today. It helps us execute the plan. You know, I think we want to be good for regulators, good for bondholders, good for investors. And that's what we're announcing today. And then, you know, that's a discussion we can have down the road.
And the next question comes from Nigel Coe with Morgan Stanley.
Oh, thanks. Good morning.
Hey, Nigel.
So a couple of questions. Firstly, on the $35 billion of dividends, you've provided some scenario analysis, you know, based on different Tier 1 ratios. Do you think you can get some of the proceeds from real estate dividend this year, or is that more of a next year issue?
Well, I think it's really a function of two things, as I walked through on that chart. One is, what level of Tier 1 common capital are we going to maintain through this transition period? And that I gave you three pick points on that. And how fast we execute against the asset sales and generate the cash proceeds. So, you know, pick your pick point on that, because we don't have that exact answer today. We think 14% is a substantial amount of Tier 1 capital. It would put you at the very top of all the CCAR banks in terms of the amount of Tier 1 common capital that any bank holds. So if you pick that as a pick point, right now that would say, based on the current plan that we laid out, that there'd be $1 billion of dividends coming back in 2015. To the extent that we can execute the asset sales faster than it's went in the base plan against 14% Tier 1 common, then in theory we could dividend proceeds faster than $1 billion in 15.
Okay. And is your plan to try and get this done by end of 16, the asset sales? Is that feasible?
Yeah, the asset sales will mostly be done by the end of 16. Jeff showed you that.
Okay. And then finally, how should we think about the excess debt? You mentioned $100 billion in 18, $90 billion in 19. How much of that would you say is excess?
As we go through this plan, in the middle years, we run about $30 to $40 billion of excess debt, and that's where you see those elevated coverage ratios as we go through that. And as I indicated, we'll look at opportunities. We don't have any liability management proactively built into this. But we will look at opportunities based on the economics of that, where interest rates are.
Yeah, let me just clarify. So when Dan says liability management, we've not assumed here that we're going to proactively buy bonds in before their maturity. We may do that. We may not do that. That's an economic decision we'll work through over time.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
The next question comes from Joe Ritchie with Goldman Sachs.
Thanks. Good morning, guys, and big move.
Hey, thank you.
First question is really on the SIFI designation. What's your probability of success, just given what you know today, the potential timing? I guess is it the way to interpret it that your plan to dispose of the assets is not reliant on the de-designation?
That's correct. Our plan doesn't involve the FSOC in terms of selling assets. We sold real estate obviously in the quarter, and we're going to start selling everything else today. So there may be approvals on the buyer side. We don't have approvals other than the regulated banks in Europe on the seller side. So it won't affect us at all. And the thing I would say is, the faster we go and the smaller we get, certainly in the U.S., as Jeff said, the earlier we'll be able to address the characteristics that made us systemic and apply to de-designate.
You know what this is Brackett Denniston, Joe. What we're looking to do, as Keith said earlier, is to apply for de-designation sometime in 16, and it will depend on the pace. The standards, you have to go back and look at the original designation order to look at what the standards were that the FSOC adopted in declaring us a SIFI. And if you look at those through much of the sales, so not even at the end point, they looked at $43 billion in CP, we'll be at $5 billion of CP. They looked at 57 million consumer customers in the United States, we look at zero consumer customers. They looked at a middle market
lending platform will be ultimately at zero in that platform. So when they looked at size, they were $540 billion in assets, then will be less than 100x cash. So if you look at all those factors, we think we have a pretty good case as we proceed with our plan.
Got it. That's really helpful color. Maybe one follow-up question. You mentioned in your prepared commentary that speed matters with these asset sales, you know, and it seems like you've gotten some pretty good inbound interest over the last few weeks. My question is there anything that could kind of derail the speed at which you can get some of these asset sales done?
Well, we're obviously subject to market conditions, and as Jeff mentioned earlier, I mean, the timing is perfect right now for that. We think the environment couldn't be better for the demand for these great franchises we have, but we're subject to market conditions. I'd say that's the one big factor. You know, we're going to have to – we weren't really planning to sell all these this way, so we're going to have to do the preparation to get the information available for buyers in the way that will help them to make their decision and help us to sort of run effective auctions. So that will take some time, but we're ready to go. We got a team that's ready to go, and our business teams are ready to go, and we're going to work to protect the customer franchise value we have and move as quickly as possible.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys. Good luck.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks.
The next question comes from Christopher Glynn with Oppenheimer.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Hey, might be a little rephrasing Nigel's question, but understanding from slide 14 the different scenarios for staggering the capital release. If we have BlackRock in 2015 and the Aussie proceeds are already in the book, just want to understand a little bit more, maybe a layer beyond just the Tier 1 differentiation. What's staggering that capital release?
Okay, so when you think about 2015, through this charge and other actions we're taking initially here, we take the capital in the company down, and then we build the capital back up throughout the year through earnings and through the reducing risk-weighted assets as we sell assets. And so that gets you back to about a 14% Tier 1 common when you get to year-end. That's why you only see $1 billion. That's why I said the faster we sell things, i.e., we reduce risk-weighted assets, which frees up capital and increases capital ratios, because that's your denominator, that's the thing that could accelerate, you know, the cash back to the company in 2015.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Our final question comes from Robert McCarthy with Stifel.
Good morning, everyone.
Hey, Rob.
Congratulations. One question I just have is with respect to this, you know, we're in a situation right now where it could be we could be coming to a tougher part of the cycle. We could be looking at potentially even the prospect of an industrial downturn. What is your kind of plan B? Because it sounds like speed is going to kill here in terms of getting us some of these divestitures off. But you know, what if market conditions don't cooperate in the next 6 to 8 months? What's kind of, you know, conceptually plan B? And as a follow up, just what is your comfort level that, you know, that there will not be a scenario in contemplated where you'll have to cut the dividend or keep it at stasis over the next couple of years?
Let me start with the portfolio plan here, Rob. You're right. You know, we are subject to market conditions. You know, if it took a little longer, it may take a little more time. But at the end of the day, we're going to build so much liquidity and excess capital. As we said, we've already got 50% of what we were planning to do is executed in the first quarter here. We got to get it closed. We may take a little longer, but I think we're going to build liquidity. We're going to build capital quite rapidly. And it just may take a little longer to get some of these things done. And if we have to trade value for speed, we're going to make that call at the time that we deal with the offers.
I would add to that, Rob, we've sold worse assets in worse times. So, again, we've allowed for some volatility in the economics here. And look, even today, before this plan, we're sitting on a ton of liquidity inside the company, right?
Yeah, starting point is strong.
So the starting point is immensely strong. Dividend, you guys have heard us say, has always been an extremely high priority, and we think, you know, the dividend is another great linchpin for investors as we go through this cycle. So it's always a top priority. There's a ton of cash available, and we think that's we've kind of mitigated that as a risk factor.
Thanks for your time.
Great.
Great, thanks.
Great, Jeff, a couple of quick points before we wrap up. A replay of today's webcast will be available on our website this afternoon. As a reminder, next Friday on the 17th, we'll hold our first quarter 2015 earnings webcast. And as always, we'll be available today to take your questions. Jeff?
Great, Matt, thanks. Again, thanks, everybody. A really important move for GE to really transform to a high-value industrial and a GE Capital around the verticals. We've got a chance to really do this at a time that's very advantageous from a standpoint of our financial service business, a great chance to create shareholder value through capital allocation. And lastly, just substantial thanks to fantastic team we have in GE Capital, who has done a great job of leading this business through a time of great volatility. So thanks, Matt. Let's wrap it up there.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.